Read Smart, the Baillie Gifford Prize for Nonfiction podcast. This podcast is generously supported by the Blavatnik Family Foundation.
Welcome to Read Smart, the official podcast of the Baillie Gifford Prize for Nonfiction. I'm Razia Iqbal. The Baillie Gifford Prize celebrates the very best in nonfiction writing, from history and politics to nature and arts. As always, we're immensely grateful to the Blavatnik Family Foundation for its generous sponsorship, which makes this podcast possible. Now, as we look ahead, hopefully to a glorious outdoor summer, and with the imminent opening of the Chelsea Flower Show in London, our second podcast for 2024 is dedicated to gardens and their role in history and culture and the challenges of writing about them in nonfiction. Today is the first proper spring day here in Princeton, which is where I am. Magnolia trees are everywhere. There's a big, big blue sky and everything else is budding and bursting. It really is a glorious day. I'm delighted to introduce two guests today, the writer, historian, and former Baillie Gifford Prize judge, Ruth Skirr, whose acclaimed works include Napoleon, A Life Told in Gardens and Shadows, and Fatal Purity, Robespierre and the French Revolution, which was longlisted for the prize in 2007. And Alan Jenkins, editor of Observer Food Monthly and the author of Plot 29, a memoir, which was longlisted for the prize in 2017, which is the year I was a judge. And I read that book and loved it, absolutely loved it. Welcome to you both. Thank you so much for joining us today. So I'd like to start, rather than talking about why you've both written about gardening and talking generally about gardens, I want to really talk about you as gardeners. Ruth, you like gardening.
I love gardening. I think I date my interest in it back to going on a school trip to Kew Gardens and buying a grow-your-own cucumber pot and bringing it home and watching it magically turn into a plant on my windowsill. But no cucumber was produced. And both my grandmothers were very keen gardeners. And my grandmother said, well, you're going on holiday, you give me your cucumber plant, I'm going to put it in my greenhouse. And when you come back, there will be a cucumber, which is exactly what happened. But in the meantime, I developed such an emotional attachment to the plant that I couldn't possibly eat the cucumber. And she was very upset by that because she was looking forward to having a cucumber sandwich with me. And I absolutely refused. The cucumber had to have a ceremonial burial.
Alan, when did you first start being interested in gardening?
Well, I was sort of given a tiny plot when I was with foster parents. But I think what happened is that later, I remember I lived in a street of squats called Elgin Avenue, and there were about 40 houses or however many it was that were going to be demolished. And they all had sort of open space. And I was working for a sort of nursery in Kensington, quite posh nursery, called Rassels of Kensington. And they used to have these skips of stuff that they threw if they were slightly unattractive, or if they had somehow passed their best, or if they were stunted in some way. And coming from my background, from any background, I think I'd have still been sort of slightly outraged. So I started bringing this stuff home. And then what I guess would have been much later called guerrilla gardening, planting them in people's gardens all along the way till front and back. They both had both front and back gardens. And I sort of became obsessed with it. And then sort of having, and also I had this relationship with flowers. I'd always, even when I had no money, that I would go to Portobello Road in the evening, and there was a flower lady, and I would buy the last flowers because I could afford to buy the last flowers easier than I could afford to buy a new flowers. Gardening came back into my life through the allotment project, which is that there were a bunch of people who I ran a team, an Observer magazine team of 20 odd people, however many it was, and we used to sort of, there would be mildly competitive pictures of their tomatoes or something, you know. And so I had this idea that wouldn't it be marvelous if instead of all having like the editor and the deputy editor and the features editor and the writers and blah, that if we took over an allotment for a year, we could all have no, there would be no strata. There would be sort of, you would go along. And I contacted Camden. There was a lady who wasn't very well. And so we agreed to take over her allotment for a year. And it had not been dug for a very long time. And we would dig it and we would sort of love it and look after it. And then we'd hand it back. And I liked the idea of doing it. The whole plan failed, or it didn't, not the whole plan failed. It was just that you realize that asking people to come gardening with their bosses on, you know, on free time, that might not be something they want to do. And so very, very quickly, there was about three of us doing it. And that kind of worked for me. And we did do a wonderful thing with it. But at the end of the year, we handed it back to Ruth. And Mary, who lived next door, who had the plot next door, said, if you ever wanted, my garden, my allotment is bigger than I can cope with. If you would help me sometimes, you can have this bit. And that was, I mean, I don't know, a very long time ago.
So let's go into the writing then. I mean, Ruth, you know, there has been more written about Napoleon than almost any other figure in history. Did you always want to write about him? And how did you alight on the idea of using his interest in gardening as the lens through which you were going to write about him?
I did always want to write about him because of his relationship to the French Revolution. So the idea that everything that he was only possible because of the revolution. He'd come out of that incredibly disruptive and traumatic period. And I was very interested in him. But I didn't want, and I'm not at all attracted to the idea of the great men of history. And I wanted to find a way to situate him in the natural world and to write about him as a human being, basically. So the original idea was to do this by looking at the shadows that he cast over other people and to use all those other lives, really, to give an outline of his life. And then the problem was how to narrow that lens down, because obviously there were so many people who were touched by him in all levels of society in so many different countries. And I had always been haunted, really, by the image of him gardening on St. Helena at the end of his life, when he had nothing left except this small patch of land, and he is trying to make a garden. And I went back to the beginning of his life, and gardens started cropping up. The first letter we have from him is one that he wrote on behalf of his mother after his father had died, when he was trying to save her from going bankrupt after his father had taken a loan from the French state to have a mulberry nursery on Corsica. And the mulberry nursery had been a disaster. And the young Napoleon was trying to stand up for his mother who had been widowed. And then there was the story of him at school, which actually resonates with Alan's allotment story there, where, you know, allegedly he was given a patch of land, it's a small patch to garden. And the boys on either side were not looking after their allotments. So he took them over and apparently very much enjoyed, you know, expanding his territory, even when he was still a small boy.
I was just going to ask you, to what extent did you discover that he behaved differently when he was gardening to how he was as Napoleon, the public figure? I mean, did he behave differently because of his engagement with nature?
I think he was often alone in the gardens that I trace him through. And this is somebody who really wanted time alone and prized that throughout his life, but had very, very little of it. So some of the times when I managed to find him in one of these gardens, it's a period, it's a sort of stepping back from the complete hecticness of his life and an opportunity to try and engage again with him as a human being, not as some kind of freak person who changed the terms of European history, but as a man with faults and with strong points. And I think in those private moments in the gardens, sometimes it's easier to capture those details.
Alan, the idea of both solitariness and solace when it comes to gardening is a big part of what anybody who engages in that kind of, I suppose it can be a very, very private thing, gardening, right? Even though you're connected to it in all kinds of ways in a much bigger sphere. How instinctive was it for you to write the book that you wrote, both as, because it feels like it's a sort of parallel story. It's not just about the plot 29, the allotment that you worked on, but it is also a very, very painful memoir that you chose to write alongside what was happening with the actual gardening, but there are of course overlaps. I mean, how did you come about thinking that this is the only way I want to write it, or had you tried different ways of writing?
No, I literally hadn't tried any ways. I was approached by someone after we did the year of the allotments to do it, but as a book, it felt slightly different. There were two things. One, because it was a personal thing, it wasn't like the team. Where we did this. It was an I, and there was a thing. And it was literally in the first few hundred words. And I think I said something like, I think I learned to love from seed. It was the helplessness of seed that called. And I thought, what the hell is that? And I can be fairly open about lots of stuff, but I wasn't ready to be that open that quickly, I think. And so I went with it for a little while. And it was another thing that I was growing nasturtiums and calendula, like two very jolly, you know, sort of commoner garden flowers. And it had only at that point occurred to me that I was growing, that they were the flowers that my foster father had given us, my brother and myself, these two tiny patches of land, which my brother was never interested, even much rather be out playing cricket or being with boys or fishing or something. And I was sort of slightly taken to it. And I hadn't realized it was that. And I thought that sort of took me. And I think the other key bit of it was that Christopher had, who's my brother, had died quite recently. And we'd had a difficult relationship that we sort of drifted apart for all kinds of reasons that, that people do. And I think somehow in the gardening, I could mourn him and remember him, and cherish him, I think, in a way that, and it was through doing rather than through saying it. But I did write, I think, something like the first chapter, and then I contacted Louise and said, look, this isn't what we talked about, and I'm sorry, and you should really have the right to, like, walk away from this, because this isn't the garden book that we sort of sat and talked about at the Chelsea Flower Show. That, oh, why don't we do this thing? I said, it's more melancholic and it's tougher read. Yeah, and I think where it fits is difficult.
Yeah, I mean, in all kinds of ways, it is unique because it is a memoir, but also it is about this other thing that is happening alongside it, the cultivating of the earth for you. And I suppose this is a question for both of you, really, which is really to do with gardening in nonfiction writing much more generally. Do you think that it is inevitable that the way in which we read about gardening in nonfiction mirrors the kind of social and cultural values of the time? I mean, Ruth, is everything that you discovered about Napoleon and the cultivation of, or the way in which his image is presented in your book as a horticulturalist is a mirroring of what was happening at the time, socially and culturally?
To some extent, yes. Especially when he's at his most powerful and he has the sort of the interior designers who are helping him realize his visions of what his palaces should be like. And they get involved with the gardens as well. And to that extent, there's a clash between him and his wife Josephine. And Napoleon wants, and the architects want, a very traditional French style of gardening with straight lines and walks and topiary, and very, very tidy and geometrical. And Josephine wants what's termed an English style garden. She wants winding paths and vistas and absolutely no straight lines. And so there is a sort of a aspect of the cultural clash or the history of gardening clash, but it's also very, very personal clash, to the point where in their garden at Malmaison, Josephine ends up saying, look, you can have this part of the garden and they can have all straight lines in your bit, but I'm absolutely having my rambling vistas and plants and all the things that I need. So I think certainly there is a sort of gardens of their time aspect, but I think all gardens are very, very personal. I mean, it's also the people who are working in the gardens, what is possible in the garden in terms of the soil and the climate and things like that.
Alan Jenkins, the way in which you structured your book could be read as a sort of gardening almanac, because you write it in terms of kind of the structures of the year, that, you know, each month.
Mm. Well, it was written in real time.
Right, right. Well, that's really interesting compared with the kind of historical research that you will have to have done, Ruth. Alan, just to stay with you for a moment, I mean, when you made that decision to write it in real time, where did that come from? Was that a kind of structural idea that came from somebody else, or was that yours?
No, I think it sort of came partly because I wanted it to start with the beginning, and the beginning in an allotment is literally the planting of seed, or the obsessive buying of seed, which is what I'm slightly very guilty of. I carry seed with me. Literally, I have a rucksack over there, and it has, and I bring in seed from places I'm not allowed to bring in seed. But I obsessively save it. And it's that, and also because I sort of hadn't really discovered there had been a world of change. It was like very early in the allotment, there were some people called the seed ambassadors that I sort of came across, and they were traveling through Eastern Europe picking up seed and exchanging seed. So suddenly they came to the allotment, and they had Cherokee Trail of Tears, which comes with a story. So it's not just a bean, it's comes with a story. And they had various sort of kales. And I think that thing of exchange of culture and the way the different people grew attracted to me. But essentially, it's also, I think, as simple as transformation, that there is a bare piece of earth and it becomes alive in another way, and that you're part of that. It's husbanding or even parenting, I think. It's that, I'm growing sweet pea seeds on some trainers on I have a roof terrace, which is my wife's thing because she's an architect and it's all pots, and whereas I tend to be more freeform. But it's from the planting of the seeds, and then I obsess about how long they will take, and I check on them, and I have been known to talk to them, and there are then suddenly these tiny brave little things break through. And then, of course, I then have this responsibility of trying to... And I think it's in the growing rather than the eating, for instance, which is sort of odd in an allotment.
That's really interesting.
It's the eating I should... And I, as a food editor, yes, I'm vain about what I grow and how well it is, and I give it space, but I oversow and overgrow. And I think I'm looking for wildness in it, in a way. I'm not one of those allotmenteers who has very... It's not regimented. I want... Oh, so, for instance, a story of a sunflower. I wanted to grow very tall sunflowers. And I found that through a seed company, which again I obsess about, that there is this sunflower called Giant. And I thought, wow, that's kind of great. That's what I want. I want this very tall, grows to whatever it is, 7 feet. And then I saw that it had 30 centimeter flowers. And I thought, wow, that's great. So I sowed some the other day. And yesterday I came across another sunflower. It's called Titan. And Titan aces giant in that the sunflowers are 70 centimetres across. I immediately have ordered those two, which of course is the act of a madman, really. I only have room for one or two sunflowers. But it's the nurture of it, I think. It's literally that caring for helplessness. And it was a way of me, I hadn't realised how much, because Chris and I had grown apart, how much we were intertwined in our lives. We were quite different. He excelled. He went into the army. He was a boxer in the army. He was quite really good at being a boy. He could punch you in the face. It meant nothing to him. Whereas I couldn't do that. I would sort of have to look away and kind of like fend something off. And it was no good at it. And it was, I think somehow that year became for me Christopher's year. And it was that, and I was unaware of it. And I wanted to, and also the gardening started with Dudley and Lillian Drabble, and then this bit of space that they gave me, which I had forgotten about.
These were your adopted parents.
It was my foster parents. And it all slightly went wrong because puberty hit. And they were also, there was another thing that it was in the late 60s, and they were in their late 60s, and when we were five or six. And so all my friends' mums and dads all had like mini skirts and orange shirts. And they had, but not they, he had a military, he would always wear this military style beret, and had this military style moustache. And anyway, it was that, really.
Liz, I'm curious, has your book been translated into French?
No, it hasn't. The French don't like to translate books on the subject of the revolution or Napoleon. So neither of my books were translated into French, but they are sold and read in English in France.
And do you have a sense of how the book on Napoleon is received or has been received? Given that it's such a, you know, it's a unique way of dealing with the subject.
So something that was very interesting was the book was published in 21, in the year, the bicentenary year of Napoleon's death. And some people who read it wrote to me or reviewed the book and said, basically, you know, I've always hated Napoleon and your book shows how awful he actually was. And others wrote saying, I've always loved Napoleon and he really comes out well through your book. And that made me think that actually I had, through this very eccentric route, really, I mean, I didn't tell my editor at the beginning of the project that I was going to do this. And I think, you know, I feel so grateful to have been allowed to, really, because if you just put it down on paper, I'm going to tell the story of this great military genius through his gardens, people think, you know, how completely odd is that? But the sense that I had somehow managed to undercut, or if you like, maybe even dig under the very polarized groups. So you either have to be for him or against him. And during the bicentenary celebrations, I'd often attend something that was still actually the end of the lockdown period. So I'd often go into one of these celebrations or commemorative Zoom calls, and it would start off, everybody's sort of trying to be nice to one another, and then it would very quickly become who's for him, who's against him. He's a very, very divisive figure, even now. So I feel very pleased that going through the gardening lens enabled me to get beyond that, actually, and to sort of see light and shade. And also, I think of the book as being almost like the inverse of the military side. So it's to do with the soil, it's to do with the climate, it's to do with, you know, as gardeners, we impose our visions. We make, you know, we don't just nurture. And I love to nurture, especially plants that are in the remaindered section of garden centres. Whenever I go to a garden centre, I go straight to the remainder section. Not just that I like a bargain, it's because I want to see if something can be rescued, and I feel enormous pride in bringing it back to life if that turns out to be possible. But also as a gardener, you make very harsh decisions all the time. And, you know, there are things you want going on in your garden or your vision of it and your plan, and the things that you absolutely don't. So, I mean, it's not just about the nurturing side.
A couple of times you've talked about the kind of human side, or humanizing Napoleon in terms of the gardens that he kept. I it's a question for both of you, really. Ruth, you first. I mean, what are the challenges for you, or what were the challenges of writing about the psychology of gardening? Because we impose so much when we think about gardening on it as something that is not just solitary, but something that is transformative, which of course goes to the heart of what happens, not just to the garden, but to the person in the garden.
So I didn't write very much about the psychology of gardening, but the chapter in my book that brought me closest to thinking about it was the Waterloo chapter. Because I had been very concerned about how I was going to deal with Waterloo. I mean, it was all very well, the garden on Corsica, the garden in the centre of Paris, et cetera, et cetera. How am I going to tell the story of Napoleon's life without engaging with Waterloo? And how on earth will that come together with a garden? But to my absolute, you know, amazement, surprise, astonishment, I had forgotten that right at the centre of the Battle of Waterloo, there was a garden. In Hougoumont, there was a garden, and it was what Wellington said, you know, we keep this. Absolutely. This is the stronghold. You keep it. And there was an orchard there, and there was an enormous amount of life lost there. And it's incredibly strategically important. And Victor Hugo, when he was writing Les Miserables, went back to that garden and sort of saw the trees as wounded, you know, the old apple trees. You could still see the way in which the battle had ravaged them and things. And there, that sense of the psychology of our relationship to nature and the brutality and the fact that, as Hugo said, you know, it was spring like any other spring, even though there had been so much life lost there. And I think that was the closest I came to really thinking, this is why you know, gardening for veterans is so important. They do that at the site of Waterloo, and why it is associated with therapy after deep trauma, because that was the point in the book where I really started to think very, very deeply about that.
And clearly, Alan, this is something that comes through in your book too, the idea that you're writing about this trauma that you've had as a child and the impact of it on you as an adult, but all of it happening and the discovery of it for you in the way in which you've written it in the book is through the gardening. And I wonder if you'll just reflect for us on how you, whether it was difficult to avoid kind of cliches, because your book just doesn't have them really, and yet there is this way that we presume we understand what gardening does for individuals and how it can provide both solace and transformation, if you like.
Yes, I think it's about sort of personalizing the space, but I didn't really have a I didn't really have a plan. It just happened to be that as I went along, I thought there was something there. And it was that I didn't know, for instance, how deeply I'd go into it. I didn't know. I knew I'd tell the story of this plot in the year. I didn't know that my life. And I was quite anxious about doing it. And I think I sort of hid behind Christopher's story to an extent, because it was that his story was easier to tell in a way. And I if someone had said to me, oh, you were in care, you could write about this stuff, and I'd have gone, nah, that's not who I am. Yeah.
Ruth, do you think that your relationship with gardening has evolved, changed, having written a book that's about somebody very, very famous, but also through a unique lens? I mean, has Has what you think about gardening shifted?
I think my relationship to gardening has shifted, but more through my own practice as a gardener. I think the Napoleon Gardens are very, very far away from anything I would ever have experienced, with the one exception of the passion for roses, actually, that Napoleon really, it was Josephine, his wife, who was absolutely obsessed with roses. And after she died and he was in exile on St. Helena, he really, really wanted to grow roses there in memory of her. And where the house that he was exiled within was located was extremely hostile terrain for doing that. And he just really, really, really struggled. It's a very sort of poignant end to his life. So now I had my own sort of powerful involvement with roses. My grandmother's sister was married to a farmer who had the farm next door to David Austin's farm. And David Austin wasn't doing any farming because he was in the greenhouse grafting the roses the whole time. And my grandma's sister's husband asked, "Can we farm? Can we buy your land?" And he said, "Well, you can't buy it, but you can farm it for us." So when we took my grandmother's ashes back to the village in which she'd lived, I saw for the first time the sign to the David Austin nursery, went there and bought my first rose, the New Dawn one. And ever since then have had a very, the roses are very central to me as a gardener. So, yeah.
Alan, did writing the book change or evolve your relationship with gardening? I mean, is it different or is it just deeper now for you?
I think I understand myself a bit more, but also to some extent there's something else, which is that of the team that started on the thing, there's a photographer called Howard Suley who took all the pictures of Jarman's Prospect Cottages, Howard Suley's photographs. And I'd hired him because I'd always wanted to have his photographs in the magazine when I edited the other magazine, and I hired him for Monty Don's pictures, which at that point had been, if not mattered, a bit gardeny, perhaps. And so I had Howard there, and Howard's an aesthetic, a minimalist aesthetic, and I may be many things, but minimalist, I'm married to a minimalist. And so that we are both there. I'm there more than him, and I don't mean to say that in any kind of way, it's just the nature of it. He has younger children. But there's also something about doing something with someone else that often involves almost no talking of any kind. Like in newspapers and magazines, it's what about this, what about this? And this isn't, that we're just there. Happened to be at the time, it's an organic site at the top of Hampstead Heath, and the light is very lovely, and there's all the things about it. But it's also about just being with someone else and not needing to speak while you do things. And then you get to take home things for his kids. But it's also allowing your vision to be shaped by someone else. It's been a marvel for me, I think.
I just want to ask you both finally to reflect, if you will, on the way in which you think that our relationship with gardening is changing because the climate is changing. Ruth, is this something that you think about?
Well, I do think, I mean, first of all, I think a lot of people's relationship with gardening did change during the pandemic. I was writing my book during the pandemic, and I was writing about gardening at the same time as a sort of almost felt like a new, national communal focus on gardening, where it's very exciting. And if that continues or can continue, and also people understand the ways in which unpredictable climates are affecting particular plants and how they bloom at unexpected times, where I am at the moment, we're very close to the River Thames, and this year the Thames came right over the bank and covered the whole of the garden, and I had just had some beds dug and was very excited about them. Sort of looked out and thought, oh my goodness, you know, this is an absolute disaster. But in fact, you know, it turned out it is for some plants, not for others, and should try to understand what is happening in a very, very micro level in your own garden, and then thinking of that connected up to the wider challenges. And as you know, for the judge panel last year that I was on for the Baillie Gifford chose fire weather as our book.
John Valiant.
And so, yeah, the John Valiant, a wonderful evocation of the way in which fire itself has changed as a result of atmospheric differences and things. So I think sometimes if you're gardening in order to focus on literally your patch of land, it can be hard to hold in your head at the same time all of our very justified terrors about what's happening. But there's no doubt that you can also start to see changes and reflect upon those.
Alan, you must think about this not just in terms of the gardening that you do, but also as editor of the magazine, that there is a bigger picture the whole time about food security and the way in which food is affected by how we grow food is affected by climate change.
But also, I think right at the minute, it's almost hard not to think about hunger. For instance, one of the things that are on my TV screens every day are very hungry looking children. So it's impossible not to be aware of that and the consequences of it and some of the cruelty and the control of it, and that food is a commodity, and that you can make a decision to deprive people of food, as well as make it, which you could almost say with climate change, there's certain decisions that have been made to you that means that these people are more expendable because they're in different parts of the world, or that their climates are more expendable in different parts of the world. The allotment at the top of Hampstead Heath is not going to, in any time soon, just become only able to grow something, but it's that I am acutely aware at the moment of, and probably in a way that I haven't been aware for a long time, of just the importance of nutrition and getting food to children, I think, in a way that I haven't been in a while, and it haunts me.
Absolutely. What a somber note on which to end. Alan Jenkins, Ruth Skerr, thank you both for taking the time to speak with us today. And we'd also, as always, like to thank the Blavatnik Family Foundation for its invaluable support of this podcast. Now, to find out more about the Baillie Gifford Prize, you can visit the website or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok at BG Prize. Tune in next time to hear more from the world of literary nonfiction. From me, Razia Iqbal. Bye-bye for now.
Read Smart, the Baillie Gifford Prize for Nonfiction podcast. This podcast is generously supported by the Blavatnik Family Foundation.